Chapter 6. Boston made two passes near the enemy formation, or near the best guess of where the enemy ships were deployed, because the Theranin had certainly moved following their exposure by the active sensor pulses of the probes. After the first pass, the heavy cruiser the Theranin had designated as bait moved to a slightly higher altitude, presenting a more tempting target, as attacking ships would be closer to jump distance. Boston did not take the bait, jumping in again to pass through the area at a safe distance, then jumping away. Then the trouble started. "I was worried this would happen," Derek said sourly on the conference call. Duchamp's eyes narrowed. "You expected this? Why didn't you say anything about it?" "I expected the enemy to do something to force a battle," Derek explained. "I didn't know what they would do. It doesn't matter. Now we have to act." The trouble was the enemy had become tired of waiting for the UN ships to engage again. After the initial paralyzing terror of being attacked by Max Hulk's missiles, their AIs had analyzed the performance characteristics of the missiles and recommended tactics to reduce the advantage of the UN ships. By using their lighter ships to form a bubble around the valuable two heavy cruisers, a dense network of overlapping sensor fields could detect incoming missiles and share data between the point defense systems of all ships. The Theranin might lose a few frigates or a destroyer, but their heavy ships could be protected against anything other than a large-scale attack launched at close range. Dangling one cruiser as bait was supposed to lure the UN ships in where they could be trapped by damping fields and overwhelmed in what would probably be a chaotic melee. The superior numbers and directed energy weapons of the Theranin would be decisive at short range, which was why Captain Duchamp had quite rightly kept his lightly armored ships at a safe distance. And that was why the Theranin were no longer using a heavy cruiser as bait. Instead, that ship had descended to low altitude, dropped stealth entirely, and was firing its cannons against the invasion force on the ground. Groups as small as a single squad of human or Verdcris soldiers were being targeted by maser cannons designed to melt starship armor. The ground force, when their transmissions could break through enemy jamming, were screaming that they were being slaughtered. They were caught between a rock and a hard place, with no good options. Soldiers who gathered together for protection against Kristang troops became targets for the big guns of the starship. But isolated fire teams were quickly overwhelmed by enemy infantry. The only tactic that offered hope of survival was counterintuitive. Platoons advancing and maintaining close contact with enemy units were so far safe from orbital bombardment. No one, especially not the Kristang, expected that situation to continue. The Theranin were very likely to drop their restraint and fire on humans and Verds regardless of the risk to the local inhabitants. Something had to be done, and Derek knew the somebody who had to do it was his ship, the only combat-ready UN warship in the system. "We do," Duchamp agreed. "I've been giving this some thought while my ship is undergoing repairs. Our AI ran simulations, and I have a tactic that could work. Bonsu, your ship and mine will accelerate. I'm sending the specs to you now. Once we have attained the required speed, we can jump in near the targets and transit the damping field within 96 seconds. Then we will jump away." Derek quickly scanned the file. "Sir, we will be in engagement range for less than 24 seconds. That's not much time for us to..." "The enemy will have the same constraint," Duchamp noted. "Yes, sir, but..." Derek tried to think of a tactful way to disagree with the squadron leader. "We can only do this once." "No," Duchamp shook his head. "Our ships will maintain momentum, even at a bit of speed from the slingshot effect. We can jump in again behind the planet and make another pass. I'm not disputing the physics. The Theranin will anticipate us jumping in a second time. They will disperse their formation to be outside our damping fields so they can jump ahead of our path and set up their own damping fields to prevent us from escaping." Duchamp opened his mouth and closed it without saying anything. To his credit, he did not glare or shout at the squadron's junior captain. He shrugged.
"That is an excellent point, Bonsu. Sir, I think we should accelerate like you suggested, but Boston's engines are fully capable. We can delay our burn while Marseille is getting up to speed. I'd like to use the time to try something."
"What?"
Sir, before I say anything, may I have half an hour to run a check?
Half an hour, yes, Duchamp agreed. Marseille will commence acceleration in 10 minutes.
Derek squeezed himself through the hatch into Boston's portside forward missile magazine, wondering how the larger Giraptha managed to fit through the opening. The compartment was not intended for occupancy by biological beings. He had to be careful not to bash his head on something sharp or get fingers caught between the feed mechanisms. Missiles were on racks, waiting to be slid into the rotary launcher mechanism, depending on what type of weapon was selected by the gunnery team on the bridge. He selected a ship-killer missile that was on the outer side of the rack, simply because it was easy to work on without crouching down. Before he popped open the access panel, he again watched the instruction video on his tablet, grateful that he didn't have to sit through an opera scene or an advertisement. The instructions were easy, and the access panel opened without a fuss. Plugging a cable into his tablet, then a port inside the missile, he...
Hello,
the missile said, startling him. A blue light glowed on the nose cone as the device spoke.
I am Multimode Anti-Ship Weapons Platform Mark 17 Block 6.
The voice sounded like a nerdy, overeager 6-year-old boy.
Hi.
Derek froze. Talking missiles were not mentioned in the fleet's YouTube instruction manuals.
I am pleased to meet you, Mark 17.
You can call me Kevin.
Is something wrong? I am, just not used to weapons that can talk. Do all of you...
Oh, this is new to us, too. Talking to you, I mean. We always exchange data with others in our formation, but really talking is different.
When did you...
I started when Skippy upgraded our programming. He gave us names, too. That was very nice of him.
Yeah, I guess.
Other than that, Skippy is an asshole,
the missile declared. Derek had to laugh.
I can't argue with you about that, but don't tell Skippy I said it.
Your secret is safe with me. How can we help you, Captain Bonsu?
Well, it's...
We can help, right? Please? Oh, can we kill something, please? That's what we do, you know?
Yeah, I... Surely you understand that when you kill an enemy ship, it's not good for you.
Yes, and don't call me Shirley. I'm Kevin,
it insisted.
I didn't...
She is Shirley. Kevin said.
Hello?
Another weapon lit up.
I'm Shirley.
And I'm Betty.
A third missile glowed. Derek sputtered. This is all a little...
When do we get to kill something? Huh? Huh?
Kevin's nose cone light pulsed excitedly.
Soon. Maybe. Hopefully.
It... Sir, how can we get from maybe to yes?
Kevin demanded. The smarmy way a car salesman would ask, how can I get you into a new car today?
It's complicated. I need to know whether you can do something. You, all of you, are able to network during an attack, correct? One of you can pop out of stealth to go active and act as a controller?
Oh, please, that is easy, Kevin scoffed. Ask me a hard question. I can control up to 23 other missiles when...
Hey, Shirley protested.
Or it could have been Betty, Derek wasn't sure.
Who put you in charge? I can control-
Wait! Derek waved his arms, not knowing if the weapons understood the gesture.
The dash 10 for you-
The what?
Shirley, or Betty, snapped.
The instruction manual.
Derek took a breath before explaining. It says a formation of missiles, your type of missiles, can take turns providing guidance.
But that's no fun, Kevin moaned.
Isn't the controller missile exposed to enemy fire and less likely to score a hit?
Good point, Kevin muttered. Shirley should do it.
Hey!
It took Derek longer than half an hour to get a sensible answer from the bickering missiles. He contacted Duchamp on his phone while walking back to Boston's bridge.
Sir, I think we have another option.
With a ground-shaking boom, the bridge behind them disappeared in a cloud of debris, the center section collapsing into the river with a tremendous splash that added a spray of water to the smoke and dust hanging in the air. Dave saw the bridge falling in his helmet visor through images transmitted by a sensor placed on the near side of the bridge. Only 6 enemy troops had made it across the bridge before the depleted UNEF platoon's sappers detonated the explosive charges. Through the dust, he could see those unlucky lizards flatten themselves on the ground, then spring to their feet and run along the riverbank toward a cluster of buildings. They didn't reach shelter. The X-Force platoon cut them down with withering fire, then finished the job with a pair of rockets. The bridge was gone. Even in a time when troops were moved between star systems by wormholes, the loss of a route across a major river could stall a ground offensive. Neither side had full control of the orbital environment, and the Kristang also could not rely on air transport to move large numbers of troops. It was too dangerous to fly vulnerable aircraft in the battle space. The beleaguered platoon should get a break now that the enemy had broken contact. Maybe take... Lieutenant Colonel Strebick called over the platoon network.
Keep moving, everyone. The map shows the forest begins a kilometer ahead of us. We'll go another 3 clicks and regroup.
Dave didn't reply. He heard Jates acknowledge. They needed a halt to treat the wounded, swap power cells, redistribute ammo, and just take off helmets to get a quick bite of tasteless ration bars. 3 kilometers. Then he could rest. Even in the mech suit, he was tired. Like everyone else, he had dialed down the power assist level to conserve the suit's energy, using more effort from his own muscles. He could go hungry, but his suit wouldn't function without power. The Legion on Globacus had no chance. Looking back, Dave knew that. He had known it all along, and didn't want to admit it. The enemy had all the advantages. They knew the terrain, and because the clans on Globacus had been fighting each other and had been planning to continue fighting each other for years, they had prepared the ground in strategic areas and had plans for offense and defense. They had support from the local civilian population, even if that support was given grudgingly with a gun pointed at their heads. Their supply lines were short, and they had access to stockpiles of food, ammunition, weapons, and medical equipment. Perhaps most important, they had mobility. Even when both sides used powered armor, and therefore individual troops could travel quickly and carry heavy loads, having ready access to simple heavy haulage equipment like all-terrain trucks gave the Kristang an ability to position and reposition heavy artillery. The Verds and their human allies had no such advantages. They had to rely on static map data for knowledge of the terrain without access to real-time satellite imaging. The local civilians ran away when encountered. They also reported the position of the invaders. Supply lines for the invading force were non-existent. They had what they had brought to the surface and no more. They could utilize captured stocks of ammunition, and the Verds could eat food taken from the planet's inhabitants, but that was not a reliable source of sustainment. Unable to eat anything they found on the surface, humans existed on short rations. The first wave's cargo had been heavily weighted toward ammunition and power packs, with subsequent waves expected to bring down less immediate needs, like food, shelters, and spare parts. The only non-line-of-sight weapons available to the invasion force were 2 small mortar tubes for each platoon. After the first half-day of combat, the handful of remaining mortar shells had been reserved for counter-battery fire to strike enemy artillery positions. That tactic slowed down the Kristang by forcing them to pack up and move after they fired a single shell or rocket, but its usefulness fell somewhere just above the better-than-nothing category. For 3 days since the Thurenan Task Force attacked, the ragtag platoon had been falling back constantly, mostly conducting a fighting retreat. Every time they thought the enemy had broken contact, the Kristang approached from a new direction, often leapfrogging the platoon's line of retreat. It was discouraging and exhausting, and the battle of attrition could not go on much longer. The only good news was that the enemy was foolhardy, small units engaging in frontal assaults without any attempt at coordination. The culture of the warrior caste valued individual displays of bravery above any sort of planning or preparation, seeming to care more about the effort than the results. As a result, the ratio of enemy to Legion casualties was 4 or 5 to 1. In the invaders' favor. Dave was okay with that. Unfortunately, the enemy had raw numbers on their side. They could afford to lose 5 or even 10 warriors for every human or Verd Kris killed. The enemy leadership was throwing their hot-headed youngest warriors into the battle, partly as a convenient way to get rid of potential troublemakers. The young warriors knew they were being used, and they didn't protest, knowing that for most of them, proving themselves in battle was the only way to advance in the clan hierarchy.
What Dave worried about was that after the enemy ran out of young warriors to use as cannon fodder, their leaders might actually start making an effort to be smart. Then the Legion would be in big trouble. It might be difficult at first to see any increase in the peril facing the Legion when they were constantly under pressure. An icon in Dave's visor switched from yellow to red and began blinking. "Shit," he grunted. "Hey, Chandra," he called the wounded soldier he was carrying. "Chandra, say something. Talk to me." "Chaika," Jaitz interrupted. "There's nothing you can do for him." "I'm not giving up, so are you a medic? His medical monitor says he has no pulse, no brain waves." "Hell." Dave knelt down, unbuckling the sling across his chest, reaching back to prevent the soldier strapped to his back from falling. It wasn't easy. The mech suit was bulky in the back to accommodate power cells and the equipment that filtered and reprocessed air, plus he wore an oversized pack. The pack had been adjusted to carry its weight on the left, balancing Chandra on the right. Hey, Jaitz, help me." "We don't have time for—" the Verd snapped. He turned and held Chandra's inert form while Dave shrugged out of the sling. "The med monitor could be wrong, you know." "It could," Jaitz agreed. "But my suit sensors agree with his monitor. Chandra is gone." Dave's own visor had come to the same conclusion. It was not a surprise. The Indian Army sergeant had taken shrapnel in the torso when a rocket warhead exploded close to him, tearing into his suit armor. The only thing they could do was get Chandra out of the heavy and now useless suit, slap bandages on the wound, and trust his suit liner to keep him alive until real medical attention could be provided. At first, the computer in the neck of the suit liner had estimated less than a 17% chance of the person inside surviving, but Dave had slung the sergeant over his back and pressed on. Getting bounced up and down on Dave's back as the platoon tried to shake off pursuit had not helped Chandra's medical nanomachine stabilize the man's injuries, and there wasn't anything Dave could have done about it. At the time, they were running for their lives, pursued by a much larger Kristang force. The platoon had been racing to get across the river that was now behind them. Before he ran across the bridge, he had called to Chandra and got no response. But the man's medical monitor showed he was still breathing, still had a weak pulse. Now he was gone. Dave couldn't argue with that. He felt a hand on his shoulder. Jaitz shook him gently. "Chaika, get up. We have to go. We have to go, or more of our people will die." "I know." He knew that Kristang treated the bodies of those killed in combat with respect. It was part of their warrior code. The enemy would not make any effort to honor Chandra's sacrifice, but they also would not desecrate the corpse. Probably, local civilian lizards would be brought in as a burial detail and to collect any valuables the Legion left behind. "Sorry." He laid Chandra on his back, arms folded across his chest. Except for the blood that had soaked through the suit liner, the sergeant could have been taking a nap. He didn't know Chandra. Was the man Hindi? It didn't matter. Dave didn't know the appropriate thing to say and didn't have time to research the subject. "Vaya con Dios, man." He patted Chandra's lifeless shoulder and snapped a salute to the dead man when he stood up. "Let's go." The Theranan commander watched as the United Nations Navy destroyer Boston, traveling no faster than on previous arrivals in orbit, jumped in on the far side of the planet, away from the formation of Theranan ships. Also away from any place where the destroyer could offer support to troops on the ground. At first, the Theranan prepared to jump in to attack the lone ship, but they were badly out of position and would not have more than a few seconds to engage. Satellites provided a view of Boston's actions, and the Theranan commander relaxed just a bit. The human warship had jumped in close to what was left of the assault carrier Chesapeake Bay, presumably to scan for survivors. The humans had waited until the assault carrier's elliptical orbit took it away from the planet near jump altitude. At least the humans who flew the destroyer were not complete idiots. That humans would risk a warship to investigate whether any of their comrades were left alive aboard the shattered assault carrier was another sign of their weakness. It was foolish and sentimental and above all just plain stupid. There wasn't anything the tiny human force could do to help anyone stranded aboard the broken Chesapeake Bay.
It was actually cruel to show that help was so close, yet so far away. The Theranan knew there were no living souls aboard the assault carrier. Everyone who could move had evacuated by dropship or escape pod and were scattered across the surface of the planet. While the Theranan had monitored the dropships and pods fleeing from the broken ship, they had not bothered to interfere. At the time, they were busy fighting a furious battle against the three UN destroyers, and if more of the invasion force reaching the surface caused problems for the Kristang inhabitants of the world, that was a good thing. It was not a good thing that the humans were already scanning the wreckage of the assault carrier, for the Theranan commander had planned to send a stealth probe over to fly inside the shattered hull. The probe would send out a desperate distress call to lure the humans into battle that would become a trap. Now the commander had one less option. She had to hope the continued bombardment of the invasion force on the surface would force the humans to react. The destroyer designated as Boston did not linger near the Chesapeake Bay. After a brief scan, it burned hard, quickly reached jump distance, and disappeared in a flash of gamma rays. Blowing up the bridge behind them gave the UNEF platoon a break for 27 hours, longer than anyone expected. The enemy might also have needed to regroup or to bring in fresh troops and supplies. What Dave cared about was that he was able to get some rest, though the series of brief catnaps left him feeling groggier than if he had stayed awake. After 16 hours, the platoon's communications tech managed to break through jamming enough to get intermittent contact with the Verd Chris unit that was less than 30 kilometers away. The Verds claimed to have raided an enemy convoy and captured equipment, including drones and mortars. They had established a good defensive position in the mountains to the east. Strebick decided to turn in that direction once the Verds provided the correct authentication code. Their luck, what little they had, ran out in the foothills. The enemy appeared again in larger numbers and pursued the ragtag X-Force unit relentlessly. Part of the platoon was caught in the open while slogging across a soggy meadow, and five dead lay there. While carrying a box of supplies on his back, Dave was helping a soldier whose suit legs had been damaged when his helmet speakers crackled with static. Then, a lizard spoke in the clear.
"Humans, you cannot escape us. Among you are those you call Mavericks."
The Kristang botched the pronunciation of the alien word.
"Surrender them to us and we will allow the others to proceed."
"What the?" Dave muttered. Others were shouting insults back at the enemy while Strebick ordered silence. The soldier Dave was helping stumbled to one knee as they climbed a rock-littered slope away from the meadow.
"Sorry, my damned suit won't..."
Dave hauled the man up, straining even in his powered armor. It was no good. The other soldier's mech suit was damaged and down to below a 10% charge on the power cells. All around him, people who were injured but whose suits were still operational were overloaded by carrying those who couldn't walk or carrying the platoon's dwindling supplies. Two squads took turns serving as rearguard, overwhelmed by... They all had to flatten themselves on the ground, finding cover however they could, as four rockets blazed out from the enemy line on the other side of the meadow. Dave hugged the ground and winced as an airburst sent shrapnel pinging off his back. He felt a burning sensation, and the suit warned him that something had penetrated the back of his left calf.
"Yeah, no shit," he grunted, rolling over.
The damage was worse than he expected. The armor on the back of his lower leg was dented inward, pressing painfully on his muscle there. Something sharp was digging into... The soldier he had been helping was down and would not be getting up. A chunk of shrapnel had sliced into the back of his suit's neck and red blood dripped out. That was it. That was the last straw. The platoon was not getting out of the fight. Not this time.
"Wait!" Dave shouted, holding up a hand towards Strebick, higher up the slope. "Colonel, I... Hey! Hey, you lizards!"
He switched to the broadcast channel before anyone could stop him.
"Stop shooting! Stop shooting! This is David Chaika! I am one of the Mavericks!"
"Chaika, what the hell are you doing?"
Strebick demanded as she halted, gasping for breath.
"You just gave away..."
"Your name means nothing to us, human," the lizard replied.
"Even you can't be that fucking stupid."
Dave waved off Jates as the Verd stumbled toward him.
"You know who I am."
"Chaika!"
Strebik was striding back down the hill, her movement hampered by the rough terrain.
Don't, Colonel, if you have a better idea.
He pointed to the injured people, some barely able to stand, some on the ground. She stopped, breathing raggedly and a shaky hand on one knee.
You can't be serious.
I can buy time.
With your life?
Ma'am, our lives aren't worth a damn right now. You need to get these people out of here. If you can link up with the Verts, he pointed to the ridgeline, maybe you can hold off the lizards long enough for the Navy to finish the fight upstairs.
I can't let you, ma'am.
The lizards will want me alive as a hostage or a trophy. I'll be safer with them than I am here. He shook his gimpy leg.
Chates, help me out of this armor. It's freaking useless anyway.
He grunted and toppled to one knee, the artificial muscles and the critically damaged suit leg unable to respond to his movements. The big bird knelt next to Dave and assisted in detaching the backpack with its heavy power cells. With that burden flopped on the ground, it was easier to get the torso cracked open, and Jates steadied the shell while the human wriggled awkwardly out of the armor. The good suit leg came off in a smooth motion, but the dented leg had to be pried off.
I will hold the boot, Jake suggested. Twist your foot and pull it out.
Yeah.
Dave grimaced in pain as his ankle got caught on something. He felt a stab of pain as his calf was sliced by something sharp. Then his leg was out of the suit and he stood up, grateful to see the suit liner was squeezing around the cut to stem the bleeding.
Damn, it's good to be out of that thing.
He put a hand on the bird's shoulder while shaking a knot out of the calf muscle.
Chica, Jate said quietly, leaning close to Dave's ear. You are a fool. They don't want you as a hostage. They know the Navy will not negotiate for your release. You will be tortured for their amusement.
He spat on the dry ground.
I know that.
Dave was surprised he was able to speak. He was so terrified his teeth felt like they were chattering. Reaching down, he pulled a grenade off Jates's belt and tucked it into a pouch at the small of his back.
I'm taking some of them with me.
Shit.
Yeah.
Chica.
Jates looked away for a moment.
Even for your species, you are foolish. It has been an honor serving with you.
Hey.
Dave laughed nervously.
Do me a favor.
Jates looked like he had swallowed something unpleasant.
Please don't ask me to tell Colonel Perkins that you love her, he said with a shudder.
Nah, she knows. I want you to stay alive, okay? Get out of here. Go home. See your wife and children again.
Shit, man. He choked up.
I regret that I never got to meet them.
I regret you are so ugly I couldn't let you meet them.
That made Dave laugh.
Thanks. I needed that.
Colonel, he turned to Strebik, limping the first couple steps.
Call our lizard friends before they do something hasty.
Holding his arms over his head while he stumbled down the slope, Dave fell heavily, bashing his chin on a rock. After that, he kept his arms low at his side, palms outward. At the bottom of the slope, he broke into a slow jog across the rain-soaked meadow at the urging of the lizards, the alien voice booming over a loudspeaker.
Yeah, yeah, screw you, asshole, he muttered, talking to keep his mind off his short future.
Glancing back, he saw the platoon was near the ridge, stragglers being helped to climb the last steps. One tall figure probably was Jates. Without the enhanced vision of his helmet visor, he couldn't tell. Jogging with an exaggerated motion that was partly him exaggerating his injury as an excuse to move slower, and partly because his knees were feeling like jelly. He stumbled and got up once, twice, three times, before the booming voice ordered him to halt. Halt where he was and get on his knees, hands over his head.
Sounds good, asshole,
he shouted, hoping the lizards heard.
Not long now.
Not long,
he said to no one, feeling the weight of the grenade at his back. It was already primed. All he had to do was press the button. It occurred to him that the safety features of Cristang grenades were weak, and it occurred to him that was a silly thing to be thinking about at that moment, and he didn't care.
Come on, he urged forward the three lizards who approached him warily, rifles aimed at his chest.
Here, lizard, he called through dry lips. Davy has a special treat for you.
Jates sprinted over the ridge past the last few stragglers and spun around, laying himself prone and looking through the rifle sight. David Chaika was on his knees, hands in the air, while three Kristang warriors walked slowly toward him from three directions, left, right, and center. The Kristang were smart. The two on the sides were hanging back, making the one in the center take the risk. The grenade would kill only one of the enemy. And Chaika, of course. Dying instantly in a blast was far better than what the Kristang would do to a human captive. Jates selected a two-shot combination of armor-piercing and explosive-tipped rounds, sighting first on the warrior to the right. Those two would survive the explosion. They would not get away. Detonation of the grenade would obscure his view of the warrior on the left. The smoke would take a moment to clear enough for his rifle's active sighting mode to lock onto that target. He would shoot the warrior on the right first, four rounds to be sure of a kill, then wait for the one on the left to come back into view. Using an active targeting pulse would give away his position, but he had to assume the enemy had sensors that could track his rounds back to the source. Mortars would be falling on his position shortly after he fired. He was not concerned about that. In his mind, he played out the scenario, so the grenade explosion would not distract him. Boom! He would not look at the source of the smoke and fire. Press the trigger, sending four rounds into the target. Only the first round needed the rifle to designate the target. The other three would use in-flight guidance from the first projectile. All he had to do was hold the trigger down gently and not move the muzzle significantly off bore sight. Then, swing the muzzle to the left and authorize the sight into active mode, pressing the trigger when a tone sounded to notify that a target had been acquired. Wait until he saw the second warrior fall. Wait that two or three extra seconds. Roll behind the ridgeline, tucking the rifle to his chest. Get to his feet, keeping low for the first couple of power-assisted strides, then get his suit into run mode. Get clear of the area. Do all that, and do not think about David Chaika, or the human sacrifice would be for nothing. Staring through the rifle scope that was superimposed on his helmet visor, he had to blink moisture away from his eyes. It was annoying, and he chided himself for being weak. He had the discipline to blink one eye at a time, never losing sight of his target. With his peripheral vision, he noted the warrior in the center was 10 meters from Chaika, close to the grenade's effective blast radius. The Kristang had stopped, his rifle aimed at the human's chest. Chaika might not get a better opportunity. He should... Chaika jerked and fell backwards, struck by a stun bolt.
No!
Jates grunted, making a snap decision. He would not allow the Kristang to take Chaika alive. He could at least do that for his foolish alien friend. Moving the muzzle carefully to the left, he... Twin fountains of dirt erupted from the bottom of the slope as mortar round struck, making him instinctively flinch, and he lost sight of Chaika.
No!
Jates, Strebeck called. She must have just noticed he had lagged behind.
Sergeant, get out of there!
Putting the rifle sight into active mode did not improve his view. There was too much smoke and dust in the air. Another mortar shell exploded, this time halfway up the slope. He got the message.
Sergeant Jates, get out of there now! That's an order!
Strebeck barked in his ear.
Acknowledged.
He tore his eyes away from the scope, safing the weapon. Chaika was on his own.